Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
Please take your seats quickly, ladies and gentlemen.
Thank you.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to The Passing Shot with Joel and Kim, supported by DownloadTennis.com. On today's French Open Round 4 catch-up,
Djokovic survives Massetti scare,
Serena out to Rybakina,
and Roger Federer withdraws from the competition.
Kim, round 4 is nearly complete. We are one match away from our complete set of quarterfinalists on the men's side and the women's side. As we're recording, Świątek is playing at the moment against Marta Kostyuk. So we have actually been talking before this podcast. What is going to finish first? Us recording in about an hour or so, probably, or the Kostyuk-Świątek match?
Well, Joel, Marta Kostyuk has taken an early breaks lead. So Świątek has break back point. So who knows? It could be a three setter. I think we might finish before. But, you know, Świątek has been in quite dominant fashion. So she may break back and then not lose another match, another game or another match. We'll see. She is, you know, the highest ranked person, I think, left in the women's draw. But we'll get onto that in a bit. It's been quite a lot of, I guess, debate, I think, surrounding especially the men's side of the tournament, which I think we should start with, because I guess most notably of all is the fact that Roger Federer, you know, he was due to play Matteo Berrettini in the fourth round, is no longer with us in the tournament. He has withdrawn. And people are a bit kind of split on whether it's okay for him to do that or he's kind of taking the piss a bit. I don't know where you stand on that, Joel, but people have been quite divided, I think it's fair to say.
Yeah, definitely. It's been a story, yeah, that has really, I think, split the kind of tennis community. You know, there are people on one hand saying, you know, it's kind of disrespectful to, you know, the French Open. It's disrespectful to his, you know, opponents that, you know, he's pulling out and treating the French Open as a warm-up event to the, you know, the grass season. Effectively, he's almost treating a Grand Slam like a, I don't know, like a 250, and people are not happy with it. There are other people who, you know, on the kind of flip side of it, are looking at it like, you know, he's perfectly within his right to do that. You know, he's got to listen to his body, and he's come back from, you know, lengthy timeout. He doesn't want to aggravate his knee, given that, you know, his best chance of winning a Grand Slam is coming up with Wimbledon. So there's two kind of really standout arguments here that I think either people are agreeing with, or they're inside of one camp or the other. I think if you were kind of asking me kind of what camp I'm in, I can understand the people who would say that it's, you know, it's sort of disrespecting the tournament, and, you know, is not particularly, doesn't look particularly great. But I think at the same time, for me, you've got to look at his record. I think this is like his only fifth withdrawal ever. I think he's got to listen to his body. We've got to remember he's 40 years old, and I know that he is one of the, you know, the greatest of all time, and I think he should deserved, I think, a little bit of leeway in terms of when it comes to kind of making these decisions. Yes, it doesn't look great, I think, with regards to, you know, we want to see him on court, and it's going to be a big shame for fans. But I think if he's got to listen to his body, then there's only really one outcome there. And he's already kind of made it plain and clear that Wimbledon is his goal. And as a result of that, this is sort of the logical decision, given that he was coming off, a 3.5 hour night match that didn't finish before midnight.
Yeah, I get completely the reasons why he's done it. I totally, you know, we kind of knew that he was obviously aiming for Wimbledon, and that, you know, I guess his intention to play at Roland Garros may have been motivated out of the fact that this could be his last time at Roland Garros, and I'm sure like sponsors as well would have wanted him to play, you know, a big tournament, and he was wanting, you know, more match practice under his belt. But for me, I see his reasons, but I think the fact that you are like 100% essentially entering a tournament with zero desire to win it. I mean, I'm sure he would love to have won another Roland Garros, but like 99% of him was probably like, I don't really care how like well I do. I just want to get like three matches under my belt. I don't know. I mean, maybe if his match against Dominic Kerpfer had been an easy straight sets, 1 hour, 20 minute long match, he would still be here. He would have played the fourth round today. But I just feel like he never, ever intended to complete all of his matches here. And it's like, can you do that? I know you're the greatest of all time, you know, some would say. I know you're Roger Federer, but I just feel it's like somewhat, some part of it is like going against the integrity of competing in a slam, you know, the epitome, like the greatest event you can play in tennis. And there's just some, it's not in the spirit of a Grand Slam competitor. That's my issue, but I do understand his reasoning and I do get that.
I do think it was a bit funny how it did come out, because it came out as kind of the, you know, it still came out in the aftermath of the Kerpfer match as opposed to like just before the Berrettini match. And I think as a result of that, people have kind of cottoned on to this kind of idea that it was sort of, you know, it was already sort of in his mind. And maybe the way it kind of came out, it was a bit, like some people might say, it was a bit too blasé and he sort of knew what he was doing. It's all being kind of calculated. And, you know, maybe if he had just had delayed making that announcement, and perhaps it was more towards, you know, the Berrettini match, and it was like, you know, I went out on the practice court and I didn't feel right, therefore I'm withdrawing, then perhaps he might have had some more sympathy.
Yeah, I think I agree with you. I think it's the way he did it. It was like, oh, I'll just see if I, you know, feel like playing, you know, if I rock up or not. If he'd have just said, oh, my knee is feeling a twinge, like I really need to protect my knee, I'm still like feeling it, there's an issue, I've tried my best, sorry, I can't carry on. That's a bit different to being like, oh, I'll just decide tomorrow if I feel like turning up or not, you know. And I think that's, you know, that's been the issue. It's like the attitude that's come with it. There have, however, been some quite witty things going around on Twitter, I have to say, about, you know, Federer playing at Wimbledon and if he's going to then like withdraw at a certain point, you know, because he's got enough practice for the US Open. There's been a lot of humour going around, which I have found quite funny. But the other thing is that people are comparing it with, you know, like Naomi Osaka withdrawing, like for mental health reasons, and the fact that the French Tennis Federation were kind of a bit like initially a bit anti her, you know, her reasoning with her mental health. Yeah, when it comes to Federer and like his physical health, his tiredness, they've been a lot more accommodating. And I do think that that is bad. I feel like there has been, from at least the governing bodies and perhaps, you know, pundits in the media, a bit more like acceptance of Federer's decision as opposed to Naomi's. And like, they should be equal. If you're pulling out for physical health, it should be the same as mental, like mental health. Yeah. Should not be any less than a physical health issue. And I think there's still a way to go, obviously, with recognizing that.
Yeah, definitely. I think for me, that was the big learning, I think, with regards to the Osaka situation. And as you said, a lot of people kind of comparing the two. I don't think they're like for like, but what it has, I think, spotlighted is the fact that the reaction to mental health, pulling out for mental health reasons versus the reaction pulling out for physical health reasons feel completely different at the moment. You know, we saw the FFT, but the, you know, the Grand Slams in general kind of almost go after you know, Osaka with quite a, you know, arguably a heavy-handed message around sort of fines and, you know, you've got these commitments, etc. Whereas for this, Guy Forget, the, you know, the lead guy for the, you know, the French Open, just kind of said, we wish him all the best for the rest of the season. And there's a massive, you know, there's a massive, massive difference there. And there should be a, you know, there shouldn't be a distinction between the two. And maybe that's something that, you know, it's going to need to be looked at in the future. But it certainly showed, I think, that the contrast that exists at the moment and the fact perhaps in the future that certainly needs to be ironed out.
Yeah, and I mean, one person who was very much behind Federer was Andy Murray, who was sort of, I guess, backing him up and saying, you know, it is quite risky to play so much tennis when you're in still one of your earliest tournaments back, and you've got to see how it goes. Like, you know, it's sort of an experimental phase almost. And he was comparing it, I guess, to like other sports like basketball, when players are, you know, given just like a short amount of time to come onto like a court and get match practice. Whereas in tennis, you know, you don't have that ability to just play half a match. You know, you kind of got to, it could be, you could be stepping onto court for 4 hours or it could be 1 hour. So it's a bit different. And I get his point. And, you know, I just wonder if it'd been another player, you know, whether the reception would have been different, if there would have been a lot less understanding from some quarters if it was someone else. But you know, I don't know, it's an interesting point about one's participation in a slam event and whether you're in it to win it or whether you enter an event for other, you know, other reasons.
Yeah, for me, this is kind of what I think, where the opportunity potentially for exhibition events could come in. Because, you know, if there is our players out there who are injured and they don't want to go kind of full throttle, kind of back onto the tour straight away, but they want to get kind of minutes under their belt, perhaps in not such a, in such a full fat format, then that I think is where kind of things like Ultimate Tennis Showdown could play a role in helping players, come back for injury, where they don't necessarily want the, you know, the pressure of ranking points or whatever on the line. So if there is, you know, if there are sort of, I guess, exhibitions out there, that's potentially how I would kind of be looking to kind of position how I fit into the tennis calendar, because it does feel like it is sort of an issue with, you know, players coming back. And it's very, you know, it's very clear cut. It's like either I don't play, or I'm going to play for, you know, a best of three set match, or at a slam, a best of five set match. And that can be quite a big jump. So maybe there is some sort of middle ground that potentially could be addressed by, you know, exhibition events like the Ultimate Tennis Showdown, which did get played in the build up to the French Open. It just might be a role that they might look to kind of own in the future.
Yeah. I mean, I've heard that Nottingham is quite nice this time of year. Maybe Federer could have missed the clay season and just gone and played like as many grass events as possible.
I think there were rumours that he was going to go and play Stuttgart, because I think the draw for Stuttgart was delayed, and there were some rumours going about that. Is Roger Federer, is he going to be starting his grass court season early in Stuttgart? But it didn't quite materialize. Shapovalov is the top seed, but it doesn't have an effect, I think, on his grass kind of preparations. And the fact that he's done this is just, as you said, it's just a sense of precaution, and he wants to protect not just kind of playing Wimbledon, but, you know, Halle probably as well. And, you know, it's all about chasing the next Grand Slam, because, you know, he's tied at the moment with Nadal, Djokovic just behind him. He probably feels that pressure and he wants to be kind of outright there. And when he's seeing Rafa Nadal on the tennis court going for his 14th French Open, he's probably a bit kind of like, well, if that's the case, I'm going to have to go back to, you know, my own sort of kingdom, the grass courts. And, you know, he wants to be fully fit for that.
Yeah, I just think the issue is that this may sound controversial, I don't think Roger's the king of Wimbledon anymore. I think that's Novak Djokovic. You know, Federer is losing to Djokovic every time they play at Wimbledon. Like, when did Federer last beat Djokovic on a grass court? I don't see Federer winning Wimbledon if Novak Djokovic is in the draw. So, like, what are his chances at Wimbledon realistically? He's got to rely on Djokovic, like something happening to Novak at that tournament. I just can't see. I know he had match points against him in the 2019 final, but that was pre-surgery. Like, I just think if Federer is struggling to get through, you know, a long match at Roland Garros, I know Wimbledon is, you know, a couple of weeks away, but really, are you going to be able to get through seven matches, like possibly against, you know, your greatest, one of your greatest rivals? And I think essentially, you know, the player that is going to take your mantle and potentially win more Wimbledons than Federer. There, dare I say it? but yes, perhaps we should leave it at that.
Well, let's move on to the tennis and let's talk about matches that did happen, because we had a cracker today in Novak Djokovic versus Lorenzo Musetti. It was a very strange match, wasn't it, Kim? It was it went five sets. Djokovic at one point looked like he was on the way out. It looked like it was going to be probably one of the biggest upsets in recent times at Grand Slams. Musetti went two sets up. He won both tie breaks. He seems to be the tiebreak king at the moment. I don't know if he's learned that from Novak Djokovic, but I think he's 8-0. I think he's 10-0 actually now after those two tiebreaks. So, I mean, yeah, I mean, at that moment, I mean, what were you thinking? Did you feel like it was on the cards, or were you still kind of, was it sort of a Federer Alejandro Fayer situation at Wimbledon where he was still two sets down, but you sort of sensed he was still the favourite?
It's funny that you mention Alejandro Fayer, because that match always brings to memories like me of camping in the queue. And I remember where I was when that match was going on. But anyway, Musetti, I think his record in tiebreaks was 6-0 and now it's 8-0. I was very surprised by that. And, you know, he's still unbeaten in tiebreaks. So all he needed was for the third set to go to a tiebreak and he would have won.
Kim, John Isner is phoning Lorenzo Musetti right now, isn't he? To be like, what's your tiebreak secret recipe?
I mean, I was thinking, you know, four words, changing of the guard. And I thought, oh, is this the match that's going to go down in history? And then it all went very pear-shaped for Musetti. It was a really weird match, like, because, you know, Musetti went a breakdown at the start, you know, of the match. And I thought, oh, okay, here we go. It's going to be quite one-sided, I think. And then obviously he came back, took the first on a tie break, took the second on a tie break. And I thought, oh, he's really exceeded my expectations. And then after that, he really massively underseeded them. I know that's not a word, but I was just incredibly underwhelmed with the rest of the match. And, you know, he was sort of having like issues with his groin, like he had a medical timeout. But at the start of that fourth set, you know, Novak won 16 points in a row. It was completely one-way traffic. And, you know, in the end, Musetti retired at 4-love down in the fifth set. And I just thought, well, where is the player that, you know, was there like two sets ago? Like, where did he go? He just completely disintegrated. And I don't know if it was the pressure, you know, being two sets up. He just, I mean, I was very disappointed that it kind of completely turned around. It's very, you know, I was expecting Novak probably to still come back and win, but it's just that the dominance of it was crazy. It was a very strange match.
Musetti, I think, showed what we've seen this tournament, the amount of promise that I think he brings to the tour, his shot making capabilities. I mean, for me, kind of watching it on TV, I think it was quite clear. And I think this was sort of something that Dan Evans tapped into in his win against Djokovic, was I think a way to play him on clay is when you're returning his serve, try and, you know, don't go for like the, you know, obviously don't go for the winner down the line or cross court. But if you kind of get it back, block the shot, get it back and give him no pace to kind of work with, and really ask the question of Djokovic to, you know, to add the pace into the point. I think that's a tactic. I genuinely feel like that's a viable tactic that players can use against Djokovic potentially to make things difficult for him on a clay court. And I think Musetti did that. You know, in the first couple of sets, he's a very, I think, also a very kind of flashy player. And I think in one sense that I think bodes well, I think, in terms of the, you know, the future of the, you know, the ATP tour and looking at these kind of players that are coming up, because I do think he has those shots that are going to kind of capture imaginations and go viral on social media. And, you know, we've seen that before, you know, with the likes of people like, you know, Nick Kyrgios and Gael Monfils. But I think here, you know, that level of creativity that he shows, I think it has more of a purpose. And you can see that even though it looks a bit crazy, a little bit mad, it sort of kind of works and is constructive for him. And, you know, the fact that he went kind of two sets up, you know, I think he will look back on this tournament as a point where he probably learned a lot. You know, he learned a lot from those first two sets in you know, winning against, you know, one of the big three. And then he probably learned a lot more from the next three sets in terms of, you know, how Djokovic came back. And he was almost kind of like the Incredible Hulk of it. It was kind of like, he just like made him angry and, he just unleashed to kind of full force, particularly with his forehand Djokovic from that third set on.
Yeah, I think there's a lot more substance to the showboating from Musetti as opposed to other players. And like, I mean, he should definitely probably, you know, get shot of the tournament. There were so many, you know, from his matches that could be up there. I think the whole top 10 would probably be Lorenzo Musetti. But it was unfortunate. He obviously was physically struggling. You know, he is probably new to the whole this was his first Grand Slam, you know, it's his debut in a main draw, and so yeah, that will have ramifications on his body. And you know, we've got to remember that this time last year he was ranked I think like 284, so he's come a long way very, very quickly. And I mean, he did do a lot more than I expected, I have to say.
Just a word on his retirement, because again, there's a lot of kind of people out there on Twitter and in the community, I think, talking about whether he should have retired. And, you know, in his interview afterwards, he actually says he wasn't kind of injured and he was just kind of doing it for the crowd. He said, just a little bit of cramps and a little bit of low back pain. I was not any more able to win a point and was not really grateful also for the crowd that was there. So I decided to retire. So I thought that was quite telling. And if I was Novak Djokovic, I don't think I would be particularly happy. I mean, I know he's probably he can't really kind of show that out, you know, outwardly, but, you know, I don't think that would come up on his record. You know, the fact that he would have come back from two sets down. And, you know, I just feel like, you know, do you remember when Medvedev kind of played through that match, you know, in Miami, when he had like loads of cramps on that, you know, in that tournament that was just really brutal on the players kind of physically. And I just kind of wondered whether, you know, yes, as well as kind of Musetti played and, you know, as much as he wanted, I think the plaudits and the crowd, I was hoping that he could have finished it, because I think it deserved an ending. And I don't think that ending should have been a retirement.
Yeah, I think, like, judging from that comment, he was thinking more, oh, you know, this is such a one-way traffic now. The crowd are just, you know, exactly. I'm not able to give them anything. I'll do it for their benefit. But, you know, you shouldn't really think of the crowd. Like, you've got to think about what's best for you. But, I mean, cramps can be very debilitating. But, yeah, I mean, for the sake of two more games, you know, if you're going to retire at four, love, you might as well.
He didn't go off in a wheelchair. He didn't go off in a wheelchair, which we've seen other players
indeed
do this week. So, I'm not doubting that there were kind of cramps there, but I'm sort of in the camp of I think he should have played to the end.
Yeah, I think for the sake of two more games, he should have done. But you know, this is his first slam. He's obviously quite immature. Perhaps, you know, in a year's time, he would make a different decision. So I guess we kind of need to give him a bit of leeway. I think everyone would probably agree that it was not the way that people wanted that match to end. You know, it was just after the promise of that second set, we thought, oh, we're on for a right firecracker of a match. And then it really fizzled out. Yeah, someone got a massive bucket of water and just threw it on the fire and off it went.
Novak Djokovic got that bucket of water, didn't he?
Yeah, I mean, to be fair, Novak said he was quite nervous before the match actually started. And he said at two sets down, he was less nervous than when he started the match. And he just started to play a lot better as well. So all credit where credit's due. It wasn't just the fact that Musetti went off the boil. Novak, obviously, the champion that he is, started playing a lot better and, you know, really upped his level, as, you know, fantastic champions like him do. So absolutely fair play and all credit to Novak.
Well, let's move on to another match involving a young Italian, because we had Jannik Sinner versus Rafa Nadal. And this really was, I think, water was poured on this from the very, very first. Well, from the second set, actually. The first set was quite tight. And, you know, Jannik Sinner probably, you know, looking back on it, would have thought, I probably should have taken that first set. But Nadal came through 7-5, 6-3, 6-love. It was pretty, you know, it was pretty comprehensive by the end, as you can tell. That bagel in the third set. But I think we were sort of expecting a bit more from this match, weren't we, Kim? And, you know, we were talking about the fact that they had played last year, and we would have been interested to see how much kind of development has happened in Sinner's game. But really kind of looking at this, I feel like it's been the same story. And it's the fact that he's been able to kind of carve out opportunities, you know, every time he's kind of played Rafa since, you know, since that match in, you know, in 2020 at Roland Garros, you know, Rome as well this year, he's had opportunities in all of those matches, but he's ended up losing all six sets he's played.
Yeah. And I think Sinner will be disappointed because if you compare, like, especially this match to their quarterfinal encounter last time around, very similar in the sense that Sinner was serving for the first set in both times and he failed to do so, and the second and third set kind of ran away from him, and you know, I think Sinner will have been hoping that he would have made more of an improvement when it comes to the scoreline, you know, from that match. I mean, it wasn't a complete year ago, it was sort of 8 months ago or what have you. You know, he's carving out opportunities, failing to take them, and I think, you know, he just hit way too many unforced errors today, like 40. Yeah. You can't afford to do that.
It's 11 winners.
Yeah, the ratio is completely off. And, you know, his first serve, I think he needs to work on that. He needs, you know, obviously he's still young. He's 19. There's plenty of time for him to develop. And I'm sure he is the sort of player that will go away and look critically at his game and think, what do I need to do? But I think he just mentally was also like, oh, by the time it got to that third set, like, what am I supposed to do?
If you look at his kind of, you know, his presence on court versus Musetti, I get the feeling with Sinner, because, you know, he's been on people's radars a bit longer. I genuinely think, and I look at his kind of facial expressions, I feel like he carries expectation now. He carries the weight of that on his shoulders. And I don't know if that's kind of impacting his game, particularly when it comes to, you know, the big matches. You know, we talk about the, you know, these kind of Nadal matches over the last, you know, the last year, 12 months or so. But I do think that sometimes when he does kind of face these, you know, the opponents that are, you know, higher above him, and maybe in his mind he thinks that, oh, I'm almost expected to kind of cause an upset here or take it to five sets. And perhaps because of that, it's sort of, you know, it's sort of impacting his game, because, you know, he very much kind of gets into the, you know, it gets into the matches, but it's just not able to kind of kill it off. And with this match, it was very much the, you know, it was very much the same story.
Yeah, I wonder if he'll become a bit of a Grigor Dimitrov, or, you know, someone who very early on in their career, you know, we sort of sing their praises and then it kind of doesn't quite work out and the expectation is too much. I hope not, but I feel that's always a route that they could go down, and we probably shouldn't put too much, you know, on these young players. A bit like kind of Coco Gauff, you know, we sort of expect so much, and, you know, perhaps it will come later on, it will come when the time is right. But I mean, I do like Sinner's attitude. I think I really like the fact that he's very calm and composed on court and very respectful, but I do wonder if perhaps he's a bit too nice sometimes
and too quiet.
Yeah, maybe he needs a bit more aggro in him to really just think, oh, sod the big three, I'm gonna do my thing, you know.
Yeah, definitely.
But yeah, I mean, I think he'll be disappointed, but, you know, he's still young, there's plenty of opportunities, and I think he needs to develop more variety in his game, because, you know, we saw today, like, big two versus the, you know, young Italians, the big two, I mean, yes, there is a big three, but I'm just saying big two. We didn't have the third player playing today. They know how to play, like, every shot, when to use the right shot. They know how and when to deliver. And it really does show, you know, you can go two sets down. You can, you know, be like breaks down, whatever adversity is thrown at you, and they will come through and deliver. And that's the difference, essentially. So they've gone through the big, you know, Novak and Rafa still on course to meet in the semi-finals. Obviously, there will be two players that will have something to say about that, Matteo Berrettini and Diego Schwartzman, because Schwartzman beat Jan-Lennard Struff in straight sets. And Schwartzman is actually yet to drop a set this tournament, and we haven't really spoken about him, but he's done really well to come through, especially because, like, prior to the tournament, he didn't really have, you know, massively good results on the clay this year. So he's done really well, and arguably the first set of his match today he really should not have won. How he managed to win that, I don't know.
Yeah, he stole it in a tiebreak, 7-6, 11-9 in the tiebreak, and yeah, it was just very, very close. And Schwartzman is one of those competitors that he has been able to do it before. You know, he faced Nadal in the semi-finals last year. And, you know, he's going to get another crack at him. Whether it's the same result, we'll have to wait and see. I would expect so. But, you know, Schwartzman's been, he's been quietly been going about his business. And Struff has been, you know, very, very solid this tournament. And to take him out in three sets was a very, I think, very, very, you know, important, I think, for him or whoever the winner was, because they probably both knew that they were probably going to play Nadal next. And in order to, you know, really have a, give themselves the best chance possible, they probably would have wanted to spend as least time on court in the, you know, in their fourth round matches as possible. And, you know, the fact that Schwartzman was able to do that and come through in three sets will help him. Kim, I'm just fully expecting that Schwartzman Nadal match. I'm going to look at the scoreboard and it's going to be like 2-2 after 40 minutes of play or something. And Schwartzman's going to give as good as he gets, but it might, I think, just kind of potentially tell out for him as well over, you know, over the course of a best of five set format.
There might be some more buckets of water by the side of the court ready to be thrown on the match. Yeah, I mean, they played last year in the semi, and yeah, there were some really long games, I think, especially at the start of the match. But Rafa, you know, he lost to him in Rome last year, but yeah, when it came to Roland Garros, there was only really one winner, and you kind of on paper expect that to happen again. I thought Diego did extremely well to win that first set today against Struff. That was absolutely amazing. Probably the decisive moment in the match really today. I mean, Struff's had a great tournament, but yeah, Schwartzman proving his worth once again on clay. And yeah, that will be all set for Wednesday. So we will see. I mean, fully expecting Novak and Rafa to come through both their matches. But let's look at the ladies event from today, Joel, because as we said earlier, Świątek is playing Marta Kostyuk as we're recording, and Świątek's actually at set point, so she may well finish before us, who knows. But Marta Kostyuk, I have to say, is looking really, from what I've seen, you know, whilst we've been recording, she's looking very on it, very determined. And obviously she had that win against Muguruza in the first round, and you know, Muguruza was totally going to win the tournament, can I just say? And, you know, if it hadn't been for Marta Kostyuk.
I mean, Kostyuk has not dropped a set either this tournament. And I think if I was Marta Kostyuk, I'd just be really annoyed with the draw gods, because I think in any other quarter, I think she would have, you know, she would have been very happy. I think she's just been the very unlucky person to have been put in the Świątek quarter. And although she's kind of come through Muguruza, yeah, she would have been hoping to, you know, to go on from there. But, you know, Świątek has just been so dominating at the moment that it's really hard to see. It's really hard to see anyone else, particularly because, as you said at the start of the podcast, there are six first-time quarterfinalists at Grand Slams left. And it just all points to Świątek being the defending champion.
She is the highest ranked player left in the draw. And, you know, she won this event last year. She hasn't dropped a set or lost a match here. She's on a win streak. everything points to her. Like, she is the bookie's favourite. You would 100% expect her to come through. And, like, looking at everyone else who's in the draw, like, no offence to them, but I fully would back Świątek as well. Let's just run through the other matches in this half of the draw, because we mistakenly said, Joel, that Coco Gauff and Stone Stevens were playing each other in our last episode.
I was getting way too ahead of myself, because Barbora Krejcikova had completely other plans on her mind.
Yes, she did. She was very ruthless today against Sloane Stephens. Only dropped two games in just over an hour
Sloane.
Yeah.
Sloane, what? You build me up so much, and then you give this performance. I was very, very, very surprised. I don't know what happened there, but she just wasn't at the races, and Krejcikova just ran away with it.
Yeah, but Krejcikova, she won Strasbourg, so she is on a win streak, much like Coco Gauff, which I think, you know, we'd probably forgotten about. So she's coming in with real form. She's also still in the doubles and the mixed doubles, I think. So, like, she's on for more than one title right now. She played really well, and she hasn't dropped a set this tournament, I don't think. And she's got Coco Gauff next, who, a similar story. She won one of the warm-up events in Parma. She's on a win streak coming into the tournament. I think eight wins in a row now she's got. And she's had a great clay season, and it's probably no surprise that she's got to her first slam quarterfinal. She won through against Ons Jabeur 6-3, 6-1 today in under an hour. So, and again, another sort of very dominant performance. It's great for Coco that she's like got to this stage of a slam. Obviously she's still only 17, but it's really nice that, you know, after all of the hype that's been made about her, that she is actually justifying that and getting to like the latter end of slams now.
I think it's kind of surprising actually, because I think in the media at the moment, the focus and the attention is, I feel, been so much on Swiatek and all the big names kind of exiting or withdrawing. And I think Coco Gauff, despite being 17 years old, I mean, this would be an incredible story in itself, getting to the, you know, the quarterfinals at Roland Garros as a 17-year-old. It's just kind of flown under the radar. And I wonder if that's kind of helped Coco Gauff. I mean, she came through very easily against Ons Jabeur. I thought that was going to be a lot tougher, but, you know, she's in great form. And I think what we can say about the quarterfinalists that we do have kind of left is that a lot of them are the form players. You know, as you said, Coco Gauff, Krejcikova, Badosa as well on the other side, they're all, you know, have had the firm momentum kind of going into the event. And, it's been a tournament, I think, where, you know, seedings has not been as much as, you know, having play under your belt. And I think that has sort of been shown in the players getting to the latter rounds are the ones who have been playing and winning the warm-up events.
Yeah, it's a bit like in fantasy football when I'm deciding my team, I look at, you know, the form rather than someone's, you know, price or what they did, you know, last season. It's what they're doing now that is important. And yeah, Coco Gauff, Barbora Krejcikova, bit of a mouthful, Paola Badosa, Iga Świątek, you know, she won Rome. So they're all informed players. And they're proving that in Roland Garros. And I mean, Sofia Kenin was not in form, and that maybe came to show today because she lost very easily to Maria Sakkari in the other fourth round. So the winner, Sakkari, will play Świątek, assuming she gets through Kostek. She's just won the first set. And Sakkari, yeah, loving the fact that she's proving the holiday vibes are going to get you the win. She's still going strong. She won 6-1, 6-3 today. Kenin, I think, you know, I saw the end of the match. She broke back and then lost her serve. So I was kind of thinking, oh, is there going to be a little Kenin comeback here? But it wasn't to be. And it does mean, actually, now we've got Sakkari and Tsitsipas in the last eight. It's the first time that both a Greek woman and a Greek man have made this stage at the same slam, which is very exciting for Greek fans.
It's definitely been a tournament, I think, you know, has been memorable for Italy, you know, the men's competition, but certainly Greece have, again, are really kind of, I think, building, you know, they've got two really standout players here in Stefanos Tsitsipas and Maria Sakkari that can really kind of, I think, catapult their game back in their country. And I think I was kind of reading in Sakkari's post-match press conference, the plan is to play with Tsitsipas in the mixed doubles at the Olympics, which I think would be a pretty fun team to watch. And you probably say, I mean, if you're just kind of going on singles rankings alone, they'd probably be one of the harder teams to beat.
Yeah, for sure. I think that would be a great team. I think they get on really well. They're good friends. Mm. And yeah, I mean, you'd have to, I'm just trying to think of what the other mixed doubles pairings would be now. I mean, is Świątek going to play with, is Lukasz Kubot still going on the doubles scene? Yeah. Mm-hmm. I'm just trying to think who else would be there. Muguruza, will she play, or Badosa with Rafa? I mean, I don't know if he'd play the mixed doubles, but, yeah, that's a whole other debate and argument and kettle of fish, but we look forward to seeing if Sakkari can go even further. You know, this is her first Grand Slam quarterfinal, so another player that's obviously making her debut at this stage of the event. But we'll look at all the other side of the draws as well in just a moment. We're going to take a very quick break now, but do join us in just a moment. We'll look back at all the results from day 8 of Roland Garros, so don't go anywhere. This is The Passing Shot with Joel and Kim, supported by DownloadTennis.com. And now we're going to move on to all the key points that took place on Sunday, day 8 of Roland Garros. And I think it's fair to say, Joel, that this side of the draw is, as you said earlier, the new big three, I suppose, we've got, with the likes of Sasha Zverev, Stefanos Tsitsipas and Daniil Medvedev. And they all won through pretty easily, actually, and they're all going pretty strong in this tournament. I mean, let's perhaps start with Zverev, the night session against Nishikori. You had this earmarked as a potential five setter. Are you regretting that?
Yeah, big time. I mean, I did call correctly that Tsitsipas PCB was going to be straight sets, and you actually called Medvedev Christian Garin as straight sets. So yeah, it was a very, very, very emphatic response from all three of those players, Tsitsipas, Medvedev, Zverev in round four. It seems that they're all sort of peaking going into the second week of competition. And I was particularly impressed with Zverev, because I did wonder if Nishikori could potentially cause an upset. You know, Zverev, I think, you know, his first match was five sets. I don't think he's been able to have a complete performance so far, but this match, I think, was the kind of complete performance, because Nishikori, you know, although he had those two five setters in round one and round two, he had a little bit of time off because of the retirement of Laxon in round three. But again, Zverev was just very, very good. I mean, he broke serve 8 times from 11 opportunities, forced 34 errors from Nishikori's racket, which is not something you would associate with Nishikori. And he only hit kind of 16 winners. And just on his day, Zverev was looking very, very good. And, you know, I think we are sort of, you know, Tsitsipas, if we're sort of ranking them, we probably say Tsitsipas is probably the favourite. We're sort of with Medvedev for the ride, but no one's really talking about Zverev. And maybe, you know, his round one match kind of put people off, given it was so topsy-turvy. But, you know, with this performance, it was just very, very consistent. And that is what you want kind of going into quarterfinals, semifinals, whatever, getting through these matches as quick as possible.
Yeah, he was two sets down, wasn't he, in his first round match? But it's a very different ball game a week on from that. And yeah, he was very comfortable in his match with Nishikori. And he's also putting together this very consistent performances at slams. You know, he's made the quarterfinals or better in 5 of his last 8 slams. And we come to expect that from him now. Whereas, you know, maybe a year and a bit ago, he was one of those players that wasn't even getting to that stage, despite the fact that he was being lauded as the next big thing. So
we're not even talking about his second serve or his double faults at the moment. What is going on? It's a week plus into the competition, and we haven't even spoken about like the Zverev double fault count.
Well, is that where opponents should be worried? Because when his serve is on, you know, he's very
exactly.
On. Yeah. I mean, he's got Alejandro Davidovich Fekina next. I really like saying his name, I have to say. and, you know, he came through against Delbonis in 4 sets. So, like, he's into the quarterfinals, first time in his career. But you would have to 100% back Zverev to come through that one. As well as Davidovich Fekina has done, I can't see him upsetting the apple cart. I think Zverev will come through to the semis.
Yeah, I would agree with you. I'm just going to say it now. I'm not a fan of his name. There's too many syllables there. I'm just going to call him ADF. But
sounds like a dodgy political party, though. ADF.
Well, I think, I mean, ADF, I think he has had 2 5-set matches. Delbonis was in 4. I don't know if tiredness is going to come into play. He's got nothing to lose. And I think when you do have nothing to lose, you can be dangerous. And Zverev is one of those players where I think he does, you know, we've seen in the past, he does get sort of flustered if his player is playing really well and he's sort of looking at his box and he's not giving off sort of the positive vibes, or he's got worried kind of, you know, facial expression. But you'd sort of expect Zverev to come through that in probably in 3 sets, to be honest. And that would put him in a really good position, I think, going into the semifinals. If he can kind of kill that one off in straights, which he should do, it can give him a really good platform and a really good crack at, you know, potentially getting to the French Open final.
Yeah, because the other semi will be either Medvedev or Tsitsipas, who will be facing off tomorrow in the night session in the quarterfinal. And this match is very... I'm edging with Tsitsipas. I do think Tsitsipas is the one that's most in form and, you know, has had a better clay season. But Medvedev has looked really good this tournament. And, you know, he's come from not having won a match at this event to, like, coming through to the quarterfinals very easily. So
against Christian Garrett as well, who we were just expecting to really kind of put up a fight. But he went out really with a bit of a whimper. You know, he beat him 6-2, 6-1, 7-5. He was able to kind of get it over the line in that third set. But yeah, it's, you know, we were talking, Kim, earlier about, you know, form versus, you know, other things. And it's crazy to me to think that, you know, the Medvedev-Tsitsipas head-to-head rivalry, Medvedev leads it 6-1. And their one match on clay, he also has a 1-0 lead. Having said that, I probably agree with you. You would still, I think, say Tsitsipas is the favourite going into it.
But now you've said that, 6-1 is quite convincing, and perhaps the matchup doesn't really work that well for Tsitsipas. So we could be on for an absolute humdinger, which is why I'm quite excited. And Zverev might be sitting pretty thinking, yeah, if they could just tire themselves out, then I'll be looking good for the semi. But yeah, I mean, Tsitsipas came through against Pablo Carreño Busta. Like you said, it was going to be straight sets, 6-3, 6-2, 7-5. PCB was a breakup in that last set, but he wasn't able to capitalize on that, unfortunately.
I think what was impressive about the Tsitsipas victory was the fact that he went from beating someone like John Isner to then, you know, in three sets to then beating Carreño Busta in three sets, two completely different types of players. You know, one player where, you know, you're not really going to get extended rallies. It's going to be much more on the, you know, the start of the point. Whereas PCB is, you know, he's a player who can classic sort of Spanish clay quarter, loves the long rallies, loves the, you know, being far behind the baseline and being in the point as long as possible. So I think what was for me quite impressive was the way he was able to adapt, you know, between that round three and round four match. And he didn't even need kind of a set to kind of get him into the, you know, get him into the mood of understanding what, you know, what it is he needs to do to beat PCB. He was just able to kind of do it from the first point. And, you know, coming up against Medvedev, yeah, it's going to be fascinating, because it's weird, because you think the conditions, if they're helping one person in the whole of Roland Garros, it feels like it's Daniil Medvedev.
It does. And I'm just thinking, I mean, people were saying on Twitter, oh, the irony if it's like a Rafa Medvedev final, and then imagine if Medvedev wins. You know, it's all this debate about the second seed. And I mean, who knows? I mean,
he's proving it off at the moment, isn't he? Which a lot, I mean, you just got to look at our collector set predictions. And not a lot of people were expecting him to live up to his seeding. But I think, you know, the fact that he's been able to make the quarterfinals, I think it's sort of, you know, he's proving the doubters wrong. And I think the best part of it is the enjoyment that he's showing, you know, on court and with the crowd and in his kind of post-match interviews on court. You can tell that he's sort of reveling in it, and he's just enjoying his tennis. And, you know, when you're enjoying your tennis, that's when you play your best tennis. And that is really what I think is happening or has happened over the first four rounds, when he's only dropped one set to, you know, Tommy Paul, who, you know, was actually, I would say, quite, you know, he's quite decent. But yeah, it's again, it's just the way you want to go in a slam. And he's given himself the best shot, I think, you know, at taking out Tsitsipas. But, you know, Tsitsipas is probably the most informed player at the moment, particularly in the clay season.
Yeah, Medvedev is a bit of a kingmaker when it comes to our collector set, because it very much depends on how well he does in the tournament as to who's going to win that. So we shall be updating everyone potentially after tomorrow night. Let's have a quick look at the ladies from yesterday, because we were all sort of potentially hyping a Serena Vika quarterfinal. That definitely ain't happening, because Serena lost. So did Vika. Serena lost to Elena Rybakina, who I actually thought Serena was going to be okay with this match. I thought, you know, she'd come through Danielle Collins. She was getting better round by round. I thought you know, she'd be fine. But as it came to it, she lost in straight sets, and Rybakina played very, very well. Like, she could match Serena, you know, power wise. She had a great serve, actually. I hadn't really seen too much of Rybakina. I know she had a great run at the start of last year, but, you know, we'd sort of forgotten about her. But she's very much back and ready to prove herself, I think.
Definitely. I was very surprised. You don't see headlines of Serena getting outpowered by her opponent, but I feel like this definitely was one of those matches, you know, unfortunately, and she really did kind of outmuscle her. And I think, you know, for Serena Williams, I think this is the sign of the times. I think, you know, the power hitters, you know, she might have been unrivaled in that area, or in that style of play, you know, five, six, seven years ago or whenever, but now there are other kind of power hitters out there, and Rybakina is definitely one of them. And she showed today her class. And again, another player who is doing really well in the doubles competition is doing that in the singles draw as well. And she will be, I think, looking to kick on, really. And I think, you know, if you're Serena Williams, yes, you didn't come in with great form, but I think regardless of kind of what she says in terms of, you know, maintaining a positive outlook, and the fact that, you know, she did say kind of, I was just literally trying to win a match. I still think you got to look back and think the fact that there's six first time quarterfinalists, you know, at a slam level, that's a big opportunity missed.
It does make you wonder if Serena will actually ever be able to get 24, because, you know, I know she hadn't had many matches coming into this, and, you know, grass, for example, is a better surface for her. But, you know, if she's going to be out-hit and outpowered,
it doesn't matter what surface.
Exactly. There's going to be someone that can hit as hard as her now. Like, there's so many players that can do that because the landscape has completely changed and, you know, the game has moved on. And you sort of do question now if, you know, despite what she's saying in press conferences, that she feels she's closer and that she's, you know, happy with how it's going. And that her expectations coming into this tournament hadn't been high, which I think is fair enough as a fair assessment. But it does, you know, I do wonder. I have doubts about her and about Federer at Wimbledon, but they may prove us wrong, as they have done before.
And I think what's kind of interesting is because of the Serena Williams longevity, I mean, Rybakina was 2 months old, when Serena Williams won her first Grand Slam title at the US Open in September 1999. And you do wonder if she's inspired these players with the, you know, the style that she, you know, she brought to the court, and, you know, these players coming up over the years, and whether that's sort of biting her behind, because it's, you know, they've grown up watching that style and been inspired by, you know, role models like Serena Williams, for example, and now that they're beating her at her own game, and it, you know, it happened in this tournament.
Yeah, she's got no one to blame but herself, Joel. she's inspired a generation, and, you know, unfortunately that might mean that she doesn't get what she ultimately, you know, perhaps wants and deserves, but she'll have to wait at least another slam to do that. And I guess another player that, you know, ex-slam champion Victoria Azarenka, we were very much like hoping she would be able to go deep at this tournament again. But Anastasia Pavlyuchenkova had other ideas because she came through 5-7, 6-3, 6-2. As the match wore on, Pavlyuchenkova was a lot more consistent, and, you know, Vika just wasn't performing where she needed to be as it went on. She missed a lot of opportunities, and, you know, she's had a good tournament overall, I think, you know, getting to the fourth round, because I don't think we were thinking too much of her coming into it. She had a lot of injuries and niggles this year, but you know, Pavlyuchenkova back into the quarterfinals after a long time, and you know, she was in the quarterfinals of this event in 2011. She lost to Schiavone, but she was like a set and 4-1 up, and, you know, Schiavone obviously came back and won that one. But, you know, you've got to pick Pavlyuchenkova, I think, to be making potentially the final. Like, with her experience, I just kind of have a feeling about her this time.
Yeah, you would think experience will massively potentially differentiate and separate out kind of, you know, who gets through to the, you know, the final, particularly because it's so such an inexperienced, you know, field at this level. And that may be where Pavlyuchenkova is able to kind of, you know, rise above. And again, it was an impressive victory against Azarenka, because I think in their head-to-head rivalry, you know, Azarenka was in a winning position. I think some of their matches were, you know, from quite a few seasons ago, but yeah, Pavlyuchenkova coming through. As well as that, we also had Badosa and Zidanzek set up quarterfinal in that Osaka-less quarter right at the bottom of the draw. Badosa came through Vondrousova and Zidanzek came through Kosteya. Again, a couple of players. I mean, Zidanzek is, I don't think she went beyond the fourth round of a Grand Slam before reaching the French Open, and now she's in the quarterfinals, so she will feel like she's on cloud nine, whereas I think Badosa feels like, you know, the job's only getting started here. You know, she's got to the quarterfinals, she came through that you know, enthralling match against Bogdan, saving a match point. She will feel, I think, like of this bottom half that's left, you know, with the form that she is in, forget kind of experience, if you're going on form in that bottom half, you'd probably say it would be Badosa.
Oh, yeah. I mean, Badosa, I think she's got the most wins on clay this season. So, you know, it was quite, I think, expected that she would come through her match. And, I mean, I wasn't really sure about Zidanzek-Kosteya. I thought Kosteya would actually come through that one. But, you know, tomorrow's Zidanzek. I mean, this sounds bad. We know we do a tennis podcast, but I really haven't seen her play before. I didn't know much about her, but that's what I like actually about players that break through and, you know, make these stages of the events, because you get to know them and you get to see how they play and what they're all about. And I mean, I am expecting Badosa to come through, but I mean, Zidanzek, like, she's made history for her country. She's the first Slovenian player to reach the last eight of a major, like, since 91, like when Slovenia became independent. You know, beforehand it had been part of Yugoslavia, so she must be, you know, pretty famous right now back home in Slovenia. And yeah, I mean, who knows? Perhaps it will go further and she'll join kind of the likes of, you know, Podoroska from last year. Very unexpected semi-finalist, perhaps.
That would be the most unexpected. But I mean, just talking on Badosa, because we've got to remember, at the Australian Open, she was one of those players who came across from the Middle East. I think she contracted COVID on her flight over, went into quarantine. She did an interview and effectively said it wasn't worth it, and you could tell the kind of struggles that she went through when she was having to be in isolation for, I think it was for 21 days. So to kind of see where she was at in the last, you know, the first Grand Slam of the year, and now where she's at in the second Grand Slam of the year, it's really, really impressive stuff. And, you know, she cites Marta Kostyuk as one of her best friends, and the fact that, you know, they were able to kind of rely on each other to get them through that really difficult kind of patch at the start of the year, because Kostyuk also got kind of COVID in January, I think. So it's great to see them kind of doing well and getting far. But yeah, it's just funny how literally kind of your story could change from one slab to the next.
Yeah, there's quite a lot of unpredictability, especially with the likes of COVID in the works. But it has been quite nice that with the French Open this year, we haven't really had like all those quarantine dramas like we had at the AO. Let's just have a look at some of the other events, Joel, that have been taking place, because we've had quite a lot of wheelchair finals today and yesterday. And Britain are slam champions with Alfie Hewitt, because he's been amazing, I have to say, this tournament. He has won the doubles with Gordon Reid. They thrashed their opponents 6-3, 6-love, beating Stefan Hude and Nicolas Pfeiffer. And that's their sixth consecutive slam title. So they have become the most successful all-British doubles pair. So, I mean, that's just amazing. They've got 11 slams in total together, Alfie and Gordon. So, yeah, fantastic. And Alfie has also won the French Open singles title as well. He beat Shingo Kaneda. So that was, I think, his second straight title at the French. So, yeah, it's just amazing. I'm so happy for them. Really, really good stuff. Unfortunately, Jordan Wiley, she was playing in the women's doubles final this evening or earlier today with Yui Kamiji. I think they lost to your favourites though, De Groot and Van Coot. So, I mean, we'll allow that because, you know, De Groot and Van Coot are like, their names cannot be beaten on a tennis court. So like we'll allow it, but yeah, a bit of a shame for Jordan. And then just a note on the doubles as well, because we have one hope remaining and that is Joe Salisbury in the mixed doubles with Desiree Krawczyk. They're in the semi-finals and we'll be playing possibly Barbora Krejcikova and Filip Pulisic next, or it could be Olmos and Cabal.
I can let you know now, Kim. It has happened. It's Olmos and Cabal. It's last on Suzanne Longlen tomorrow. So let's just look at the order of play for tomorrow. We're going to do some mini predictions for the quarterfinals. We've got Zidanec Bedosa, Rybakina Pavlyuchenkova, Zverev, ADF, Davidovich Fokina, and then the night match we've got Tsitsipas Medvedev. I mean, where are your eyes drawn to on that Philippe Chatrier order of play?
Oh, for sure. The night session. Tsitsipas, yeah. Medvedev. Popcorn at the ready, please. Nice beverage or two in the hand. Yeah, definitely. I mean, I'm quite intrigued by Rybakina, actually, to see how well she can do against Pavs. I expect Pavs will come through, but it could go three sets. I think, you know, but I don't know. Well, Pavlyuchenkova's got, you know, that strapping on her knee. So I don't know if that might play a factor as the event goes on. But yeah, I mean, I think Tsitsipas Medvedev, that is a very worthy night session. I mean, actually, talking about the night sessions, it's interesting that Świątek has got the night session tonight, because we were saying in our last pod that, like, there's only been one women's match in the night session, and then lo and behold, they give it to Świątek, which is absolutely fair dues, because we were all saying that it should be Rafa and Sinner, but obviously that match in the end did not really end out the way that some people thought it might. So, yeah, I mean, what about you, Joel? Are you expecting a lot of straight sets victories tomorrow? Or
I sort of agree with you. I feel like the two competitive quarterfinals will be Rybakina and Pavlyuchenkova, Tsitsipas Medvedev. If you're going to push me for some mini predictions, I've got Bedosa in two, Pavs in two, Zverev in four, and I've got Tsitsipas in five.
Mm, okay, yeah, I agree with you. I've got Zverev in three, though, and Tsitsipas in four. But, you know, Daniil may prove us wrong. I actually feel like, I don't know where the crowd, or there won't be a crowd, will there? I was about to say, where will the crowd be at that? Who are they going to support? But there won't be a crowd. So that's an absolutely null and void question.
Watching on their sofa.
Yeah. like in the Eurovision Song Contest, they had this weird thing where you could vote on an app, like, and it would translate into crowd noise in the arena. But they could do something like that, you know, where you sort of press a button on your phone and someone yells out in Philippe Chatrier. But yeah, we'll see how it goes. And we'll obviously be rounding it up on Wednesday, whatever does happen. Just before we go, Joel, I suppose we should quickly touch upon the grass court events that have started, and Nottingham's got underway. Lots of Brits in action. I think Katie Balter won today against Osorio Serrano, who's probably not so au fait with the grass court.
No, I wouldn't have thought so. Balter would have been in big trouble, I think, if she'd had lost that. But we've also had the Stuttgart draw as well, which starts tomorrow, the main draw. Shapovalov is the top seed. Hubert Hurkacz is the second seed. You've got Dumanur and Ogier Aliassime as well, rounding out the top four seeds. You know, looking at the draw, I think it's pretty good to draw, given it's, you know, the second week of a Grand Slam. Obviously, there are a lot of dropouts, but, you know, I'm glad to see Shapovalov back, because, you know, he didn't play the French Open because of the injury, and we thought he was going to be one of the, you know, the danger players, I think, but, you know, his body wasn't ready. So it's great to see him back. I have got my eye though, Kim, on Lloyd Harris. I know he lost to Cam Norrie, but I just think he has a pretty good game for a grass court. And I wonder if he might be quite a difficult person to beat. I know he's unseeded, but that's sort of my thinking. I mean, Ogier Aliassime, again, there's always gonna be questions. Can he win a 250? Can he win a final? Where are your eyes drawn to?
Well, I just wonder if Feliciano Lopez is going to do a bit of a Roger Federer and, you know, he's got to be...
His Queens build up.
Exactly.
His Queens build up.
He might be like, well, I've got to be in Queens in a week, so I might just rock up, get to the quarters and then decide to pull out. No, I mean, I hope he does well. He's great on grass. Dominic Koepfer is also involved and, you know, he sort of made a bit of a name for himself the other night. So, and Jeremy Chardy, I think he's always pretty handy on a grass court. So Dustin Brown also back in action with a wild card in his home event. Just on the news of grass and Wimbledon, Carl Edmund has unfortunately withdrawn from Wimbledon. He's still recovering from knee surgery. So, oh, he's, you know, 70 in the rankings now, and it looks like he's going to be possibly out of the top 100 soon if things don't continue to look up for him. And also, Jeannie Bouchard has had surgery on her shoulder. So it's a bit of a shame because she was kind of working her way back up a bit, but she probably will be out for a bit with that. So yeah, just a few updates there.
And listeners, that about wraps it up for this episode of The Passing Shot. If you want to stay up to date on everything at the French Open, make sure to subscribe to us on your podcasting platform of choice, whether that's Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Overcast, Castbox, Stitcher. And you can also listen to us on the DownloadTennis.com app. If you have been enjoying listening to the podcast over the last few weeks and you want to help out the show, make sure to leave us a rating and comment as well on Apple Podcasts.
And you can follow us on social media. We're on Twitter, Instagram and Facebook at Passing Shot Pod. So do give us a like, give us a follow if you don't already. And you can contact us on all those social channels if you want to let us know any feedback or if you have any queries at all. We do always love to hear from everyone. And you can also contact us via email, passingshotpod@gmail.com.
And we will be back on Wednesday evening, UK time, for our quarterfinal round by round catch up. I hope you can join us for that. And we will see you again soon.